war going on. But when the last of the drunks was shuffled onto his feet and ushered into a cab, Belly, feeling not the least bit tired, asked Tina, "Can we go back?"
"Where?"
"To El Hollywood."
"But we have to change. Don't worry, I brought everything."
And before you know it, she was standing over his table. One of his dinner companions said,
"Hey, Dionisio, isn't that the girl que te dio una pela last week?"
The baller nodded glumly. His buddy looked her up and down.
"I hope for your sake she's not back for a rematch. I don't think you'll survive."
"What are you waiting for?" the baller asked.
"The bell?"
"Dance with me."
Now it was her turn to grab him and drag him onto the pista. He might have been a dense slab of tuxedo and thew, but he moved like an enchantment.
"You came looking for me, didn't you?"
"Yes," she said,
and only then did she know.
"I'm glad you didn't lie. I don't like liars."
He put his finger under her chin.
"What's your name?"
She tore her head away.
"My name is Hipatia Belicia Cabral."
"No," he said with the gravity of an old-school pimp. "Your name is beautiful." The gangster we're all looking for. How much Belly knew about the gangster, we will never know. She claims that he only told her he was a businessman.
Of course I believed him. How was I supposed to know different?
Well, he certainly was a businessman, but he was also a flunky for the Trujillato, and not a minor one. Don't misunderstand. Our boy wasn't no ringwraith, but he wasn't no orc either. Due partially to Belly's silence on the matter and other folks' lingering unease when it comes to talking about the regime, info on the gangster is fragmented. I'll give you what I've managed to unearth, and the rest will have to wait for the day the páginas en blanco finally speak. The gangster was born in Samaná at the dawn of the 20s, the fourth son of a milkman, a bawling, worm-infested brat no one thought would amount to na, an opinion his parents endorsed by turning him out of the house when he was 7. But folks always underestimate what the promise of a lifetime of starvation, powerlessness, and humiliation can provoke in a young person's character. By the time the gangster was 12, this scrawny, unremarkable boy had shown a resourcefulness and fearlessness beyond his years. His claims that the failed cattle thief had inspired him brought him to the attention of the secret police. And before you could say simsalabim, our boy was infiltrating unions and fingering sindicatos left and right. At age 14, he killed his first comunista, a favor for the appalling Felix Bernardino. And apparently the hit was so spectacular, so fucking chunky, that half the left in Baní immediately abandoned the DR for the relative safety of Nueva York. With the money he earned, he bought himself a new suit and 4 pairs of shoes. From that point on, the sky was the limit for our young villain. Felix Wenceslao Bernardino, raised in La Romana, one of Trujillo's most sinister agents, his witch king of Angmar, was consul in Cuba when the exiled Dominican labor organizer Mauricio Valles was mysteriously murdered on the streets of Havana. Felix was also rumored to have had a hand in the failed assassination of Dominican exile leader Angel Morales. The assassins burst in on his secretary shaving, mistook the lathered man for Morales, and shot him to pieces. In addition, Felix and his sister Minerva Bernardino, first woman in the world to be an ambassador before the United Nations, were both in New York City when Jesus de Galíndez mysteriously disappeared on his way home at the Columbus Circle subway station. Talk about have gun will travel. It was said the power of Trujillo never left him. The fucker died of old age in Santo Domingo, Trujillista to the end, drowning his Haitian workers instead of paying them. Over the next decade, the gangster traveled back and forth to Cuba, dabbled in forgery, theft, extortion, and money laundering, all for the everlasting glory of the Trujillato. It was even rumored, never substantiated, that our gangster was the hammer man who slew Mauricio Baez in Havana in 1950. Who can know? It seems a possibility. By then he'd acquired deep contacts in the Havana underworld and clearly had no compunction about slaying motherfuckers. Hard evidence, though, is scarce. That he was a favorite of Johnny Aves and of Porfirio Rubirosa, there can be no denying. He had a special passport from the Palacio and the rank of major in some branch of the secret police. Skilled our gangster became in many a perfidy, but where our man truly excelled, where he smashed records and grabbed gold, was in the flesh trade. Then, like now, Santo Domingo was to Popola what Switzerland was to chocolate. And there was something about the binding, selling, and degradation of women that brought out the best in the gangster. He had an instinct for it, a talent. Call him the Caracaracol of Culo. By the time he was 22, he was operating his own string of brothels in and around the capital, owned houses and cars in three countries. Never stinted the jefe on anything, be it money, praise, or a prime cut of culo from Colombia. And so loyal was he to the regime that he once slew a man at a bar, simply for pronouncing el jefe's mother's name wrong. "Now here's a man," el jefe was rumored to have said, "who is capaz." The gangster's devotion did not go unrewarded. By the mid-40s, the gangster was no longer simply a well-paid operator. He was becoming an alien. In photos, he appears in the company of the regime's three witch kings, Johnny Aves, Joaquin Balaguer, and Felix Bernardino. And while none exists of him in El Jefe, that they broke bread and talked shit cannot be doubted. For it was the great I himself who granted the gangster authority over a number of the Trujillo family's concessions in Venezuela and Cuba. And under his draconian administration, the so-called bang-for-the-buck ratio of Dominican sex workers trebled. In the 40s, the gangster was in his prime. He traveled the entire length of the Americas, from Rosario to Nueva York, in pimp daddy style. Staying at the best hotels, banging the hottest broads. Never lost his Sureño taste for the morenas, though. Dining in four-star restaurants, confabbing with arch-criminals the world over. An inexhaustible opportunist, he spun deals everywhere he went. Suitcases of dollars accompanied him back and forth from the capital. Life was not always pleasant. Plenty of acts of violence, plenty of beatdowns and knifings. He himself survived any number of gang attempts, and after each shootout, after each drive-by, he always combed his hair and straightened his tie. A dandy's reflex. He was a true gangster. Gully to the bone. Lived the life all those phony rap acts can only rhyme about. It was also in this period that his long dalliance with Cuba was formalized. The gangster might have harbored love for Venezuela and its many long-legged mulatas, and burned for the tall icy beauties of Argentina, and swooned over Mexico's incomparable brunettes. But it was Cuba that clove his heart, that felt to him like home. If he spent 6 months out of 12 in Havana, I'd call that a conservative estimate. And in honor of his predilections, the secret police's code name for him was Max Gomez. So often did he travel to Havana that it was more a case of inevitability than bad luck that on New Year's Eve 1958, the night that Fulgencio Batista sacó pies out of Havana and the whole of Latin America changed, the gangster was actually partying with Johnny Aves in Havana, sucking whiskey out of the navels of underage whores when the guerrillas reached Santa Clara. It was only the timely arrival of one of the gangster's informants that saved them all. "You better leave now, or you'll all be hanging from your huevos." In one of the greatest blunders in the history of Dominican intelligence, Johnny Abes almost didn't make it out of Havana that New Year's Eve. The Dominicans were literally on the last plane smoking, the gangster's face pressed against the glass, never to return. When Belly encountered the gangster, that ignominious midnight flight still haunted him. Beyond the financial attachment, Cuba was an important component to his prestige, to his manhood, really. And our man could still not accept the fact that the country had fallen to a rabble of scurvied students. Some days he was better than others. But whenever the latest news reached him of the revolution's activities, he would pull his hair and attack the nearest wall in sight. Not a day passed when he didn't fulminate against Batista, that ox, that peasant, or Castro, the goat-fucking comunista, or CIA chief Alan Dulles, that effeminate, who had failed to stop Batista's ill-advised Mother's Day amnesty that freed Fidel and the other Moncadistas to fight another day. "If Dulles was right here in front of me, I'd shoot him dead," he swore to Belly. "And then, I'd shoot his mother dead." Life, it seemed, had struck the gangster a dolorous blow, and he was uncertain as how to respond. The future appeared cloudy, and there was no doubt he sensed his own mortality and that of Trujillo in the fall of Cuba. Which might explain why, when he met Belly, he jumped on her stat. I mean, what straight middle-aged brother has not attempted to regenerate himself through the alchemy of young pussy? And if what was often said to her daughter was true, Belly had some of the finest pussy around. The sexy isthmus of her waist alone could have launched 1,000 Yolas. And while the upper-class boys might have had their issues with her, the gangster was a man of the world. Had fucked more prietas than you could count. He didn't care about that shit. What he wanted was to suck Belly's enormous breasts, to fuck her pussy until it was a mango juice swamp, to spoil her senseless so that Cuba and his failure there disappeared. As the viejos say, clavo saca clavo, and only a girl like Belly could erase the debacle of Cuba from a brother's mind. At first, Belly had her reservations about the gangster. Her ideal amor had been Jack Pujols, and here was this middle-aged Caliban who dyed his hair and had a thatch of curlies on his back and shoulders. More like a third-base umpire than an avatar of her glorious future. But one should never underestimate what assiduity can accomplish, when assisted by heaping portions of lana and privilege. The gangster romanced the girl like only middle-aged niggers know how. Chipped at her reservation with cool aplomb and unself-conscious coursiness. Rained on her head enough flowers to garland Aswa, bonfires of roses at the job and her house. "It's romantic," Tina sighed. "It's vulgar," La Inca complained. He escorted her to the most exclusive restaurants of the capital. Took her to the clubs that had never tolerated a non-musician Prieto inside their door before. Dude was that powerful, to break the injunction against black. Places like the Amaca, the Tropicalia, though not alas the country club, even he didn't have the juice. He flattered her with top-notch muelas. From what I heard, he paid a couple of grad school Cyranos to churn them out. Treated her to plays, movies, dances, bought her wardrobes of clothes and pirate chests of jewelry, introduced her to famous celebrities, and once, even to Ramfis Trujillo himself. In other words, he exposed her to the fucking world, at least the one circumscribed by the DR. And you'd be surprised how even a hard-headed girl like Belly, committed as she was to an idealized notion of what love was, could find it in her heart to revise her views, if only for the gangster. He was a complicated, some would say comical, affable, some would say laughable, man, who treated Belly very tenderly and with great consideration. And under him, literally and metaphorically, The education begun at the restaurant was completed. He was un hombre bien social, enjoyed being out and about, seeing and being seen, and that dovetailed nicely with Belly's own dreams. But also un hombre conflicted about his past deeds. On the one hand, he was proud of what he'd accomplished. I made myself, he told Belly, all by myself. I have cars, houses, electricity, clothes, prendas. But when I was a niño, I didn't even own a pair of shoes, not one pair. I had no family. I was an orphan. Do you understand? She, an orphan herself, understood profoundly. On the other hand, he was tormented by his crimes. When he drank too much, and that was often, he would mutter things like, If you only knew the diabluras I've committed, you wouldn't be here right now. And on some nights, she would wake up to him crying.
I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean it.
And it was on one of those nights, while she cradled his head and brushed away his tears, that she realized with a start that she loved this gangster. Belly in love, round two. But unlike what happened with Pujols, this was the real deal. Pure, uncut, unadulterated love. The holy grail that would so bedevil her children throughout their lives. Consider that Belly had longed, hungered for a chance to be in love and to be loved back. Not very long in real time, but a forever by the chronometer of her adolescence. Never had the opportunity in her first lost childhood, and in the intervening years, her desire for it had doubled over and doubled over like a katana being forged until finally it was sharper than the truth. With the gangster, our girl finally got her chance. Who is surprised that in the final 4 months of her relationship with him, there would be such an outpouring of effect? As expected. She, the daughter of the fall, recipient of its heaviest radiations, loved atomically. As for the gangster, he normally would have tired right quick of such an intensely adoring plaything. But our gangster, grounded by the hurricane winds of history, found himself reciprocating, writing checks with his mouth that his ass could never hope to cover. He promised her that once the troubles with the communists were over, he would take her to Miami and to Havana. I'll buy you a house in both places just so you can know how much I love you. A house? She whispered, her hair standing on end. You're lying to me. I do not lie. How many rooms do you want? 10? She said uncertainly. 10 is nothing. Make it 20. The thoughts he put in her head. Someone should have arrested him for it. And believe me, La Inca considered it. He's a panderer, she declaimed. A thief of innocence. There's a pretty solid argument to be made that La Inca was right. The gangster was simply an old chulo preying on Belly's naivete. But if you looked at it from, say, a more generous angle, you could argue that the gangster adored our girl, and that adoration was one of the greatest gifts anybody had ever given her. It felt unbelievably good to Belly, shook her to her core. For the first time, I actually felt like I owned my skin, like it was me and I was it. He made her feel guapa and wanted and safe, and no one had ever done that for her. No one. On their nights together, he would pass his hand over her naked body, Narcissus stroking that pool of his, murmuring guapa, guapa, over and over again. He didn't care about the burn scars on her back. It looks like a painting of a ciclón, and that's what you are, mi negrita. Una tormenta en la madrugada. The randy old goat could make love to her from sun up to sundown, and it was he who taught her all about her body, her orgasms, her rhythms, who said, "You have to be bold." And for that, he must be honored, no matter what happened in the end. This was the affair that once and for all incinerated Belly's reputation in Santo Domingo. No one in Baní knew exactly who the gangster was and what he did. He kept his shit hush-hush. But it was enough that he was a man. In the minds of Belly's neighbors, that Prieta Comparona had finally found her true station in life as a cuero. Old-timers have told me that during her last months in the DR, Belly spent more time inside the love motels than she had in school. An exaggeration, I'm sure. But a sign of how low our girl had fallen in the pueblo's estimation. Belly didn't help matters. Talk about a poor winner. Now that she'd vaulted into a higher order of privilege, she strutted around the neighborhood, exulting and heaping steaming piles of contempt on everybody and everything that wasn't the gangster, dismissing her barrio as an infierno and her neighbors as brutos and cochinos. She bragged about how she would be living in Miami soon, wouldn't have to put up with this un-country much longer. Our girl no longer maintained even a modicum of respectability at home. Stayed out until all hours of the night and permed her hair whenever she wanted. La Inca didn't know what to do with her anymore. All her neighbors advised her to beat the girl into a blood clot. "You might even have to kill her," they said regretfully. But La Inca couldn't explain what it had meant to find the burnt girl locked in a chicken coop all those years ago. How that sight had stepped into her and rearranged everything so that now she found she didn't have the strength to raise her hand against the girl. She never stopped trying to talk sense into her, though. "What happened to college?" "I don't want to go to college." "So what are you going to do? Be a gangster's girlfriend your whole life? Your parents, God rest their souls, wanted so much better for you." "I told you not to talk to me about those people. You're the only parents I have. And look how well you've treated me. Look how well." "Maybe people are right," La Inca despaired.
"Maybe you are cursed."
Belly laughed. "You might be cursed, but not me." Even the Chinos had to respond to Belly's change in attitude. "We have you go," Juan said.
"I don't understand."
He licked his lips and tried again.
"We have to you go. You're fired," Jose said. "Please leave your apron on the counter."
The gangster heard about it, and the next day some of his goons paid the brothers 10 a visit. And what do you know if our girl wasn't immediately reinstated? It wasn't the same no more, though. The brothers wouldn't talk to her, wouldn't spin no stories about their youth in China and the Philippines. After a couple of days of the silent treatment, Belly took the hint and stopped showing up altogether. "And now you don't have a job," La Inca pointed out helpfully.
"I don't need a job. He's going to buy me a house."
"A man whose own house you yourself have never visited is promising to buy you a house? And you believe him?"
"Oh, hija."
"Yes, sir." Our girl believed. After all, she was in love. The world was coming apart at the seams. Santo Domingo was in the middle of a total meltdown. The Trujillato was tottering, police blockades on every corner, and even the kids she'd gone to school with, the brightest and the best, were being swept up by the terror. A girl from El Redentor told her that Jack Pujol's little brother had gotten caught organizing against El Jefe, and the colonel's influence could not save the boy from having an eye gouged out with electric shocks. Belly didn't want to hear it. After all, she was in love. In love. She wafted through her day like a woman with a concussion. It's not like she had a number for the gangster, or even an address. Bad sign number one, girls. And he was in the habit of disappearing for days without warning. Bad sign number two. And now that Trujillo's war against the world was reaching its bitter crescendo, and now that he had Belly on lock, the days could become weeks, and when he reappeared from his business, he would smell of cigarettes and old fear and want only to fuck, and afterward he would drink whiskey and mutter to himself by the Love Motel window. His hair, Belly noticed, was growing in gray. She didn't take kindly to these disappearances. They made her look bad in front of La Inca and the neighbors, who were always asking her sweetly, "Where's your savior now, Moses?" She defended him against every criticism, of course. No brother has had a better advocate. But then took it out on his ass upon his return. Pouted when he appeared with flowers. Made him take her to the most expensive restaurants. Pestered him around the clock to move her out of her neighborhood. Asked him what the hell he'd been doing these past X days. Talked about the weddings she'd read about in the Listín. And just so you can see that La Inca's doubts were not entirely wasted, wanted to know when he was going to bring her to his house. Hija de la gran puta, would you stop jodiéndome? We're in the middle of a war here. He stood over her in his wife beater, waving a pistol. Don't you know what the communists do to girls like you? They'll hang you up by your beautiful tits, and then they'll cut them off, just like they did to the whores in Cuba. During one of the gangster's longer absences, Belly, bored and desperate to escape the schadenfreude in her neighbor's eyes, took it upon herself to ride the Blue Ball Express one last time. In other words, she checked in on her old flames. Ostensibly, she wanted to end things in a formal way, but I think she was just feeling down and wanted male attention. Which is fine. But then she made the classic mistake of telling these Dominican hombres about the new love of her life, how happy she was. Sisters, don't ever, ever do this. It's about as smart as telling the judge who's about to sentence you that back in the day you finger-fucked his mother. The car dealer, always so gentle, so decorous, threw a whiskey bottle at her, screaming, "Why should I be happy for a stupid, stinking Mona?" They were in his apartment on the Malecón. At least he showed you his house, Constantina would later crack. And if he had been a better righty, she would have ended up brained, perhaps raped and killed. But his fastball only grazed her, and then it was her turn on the mound. She put him away with four sinkers to the head, using the same whiskey bottle he'd thrown at her. 5 minutes later, panting and barefoot in a cab, she was pulled over by the secret police, tipped off because they'd seen her running, and it was only when they questioned her that she realized that she was still holding the bottle, and it had bloody hair on one of its edges. The car dealer's straight blonde hair. Once they heard what happened, they let me go. To his credit, Archimedes acquitted himself in a more mature fashion. Maybe because she told him first and had not yet grown flip. After her confession, she heard a little noise from the closet where he was hiding and nothing else. 5 minutes of silence, and then she whispered, "I'd better go." She never saw him again in person, only on the TV, giving speeches, and in later years would wonder if he still thought of her, as she sometimes did of him. "What have you been up to?" the gangster asked the next time he appeared.
"Nothing," she said, throwing her arms around his neck. "Absolutely nothing."
A month before it all blew up, the gangster took Belly on a vacation to his old haunts in Samaná. Their first real trip together. A peace offering, prompted by a particularly long absence. A promissory note for future trips abroad. For those capitaleños who never leave the 27 de Febrero or who think Gualé is the center of the universe, Samaná es una chulería. One of the authors of the King James Bible traveled the Caribbean, and I often think that it was a place like Samaná that was on his mind when he sat down to pen the Eden chapters. For Eden it was, a blessed meridian where mar and sol and green have forged their union and produced a stubborn people that no amount of highfalutin prose can generalize. The gangster was in high spirits. The war against the subversives was going well, it seemed. "We got him on the run," he gloated. "Very soon, all will be well." As for Belly, she remembered the trip as the nicest time she'd ever had in the DR. She would never again hear the name Samana without recalling that final primavera of her youth, the primavera of her perfection, when she was still young and beautiful. Samana would forever evoke memories of their lovemaking, of the gangster's rough chin scraping her neck, of the sound of the Mar Caribe romancing those flawless, resortless beaches, of the safety she experienced, and the promise. Three photos from that trip, and in every one, she's smiling. They did all the stuff we Dominicans love to do on our vacations. They ate pescado frito and waded in the río. They walked along the beach and drank rum until the meat behind their eyes throbbed. It was the first time ever that Belly had her own space totally under her control, so while the gangster dozed restfully in his hamaca, she busied herself with playing wife, with creating a preliminary draft of the household they would soon inhabit. Mornings, she would subject the cabana to the harshest of scourings and hang boisterous profusions of flowers from every beam and around every window, while her bartering produce and fish from the neighbors resulted in one spectacular meal after another, showing off the skills she acquired during the lost years. And the gangster's satisfaction, the patting of his stomach, the unequivocal praise, the soft emission of gases as he lay in the hamaca, it was music to her ears. In her mind, she became his wife that week in every sense but the legal. She and the gangster even managed to have heart-to-hearts. On the second day, after he showed her his old home, now abandoned and hurricane-ruined, she asked, "Do you ever miss having a family?" They were at the only nice restaurant in the city, where El Jefe dined on his visits. They'll still tell you that. "You see those people?" He pointed toward the bar. "All those people have families, you can tell by their faces. They have families that depend on them and that they depend on. And for some of them this is good, and for some of them this is bad. But it all amounts to the same shit because there isn't one of them who is free. They can't do what they want to do or be who they should be. I might have no one in the world, but at least I'm free." She had never heard anyone say those words. "I'm free" wasn't a popular refrain in the era of Trujillo. But it struck a chord in her, put La Inca and her neighbors and her still up-in-the-air life in perspective. "I'm free. I want to be like you," she told the gangster days later when they were eating crabs she'd cooked in an achiote sauce. He'd just been telling her about the nude beaches of Cuba. "You would have been the star of the show," he said, pinching her nipple and laughing. "What do you mean, you want to be like me?"
"I want to be free."
He smiled and chucked her under the chin.
"Then you will be, mi negra bella."
The next day, the protective bubble about their idol finally burst, and the troubles of the real world came rushing in. A motorcycle driven by a hugely overweight policeman arrived at their cabana.
"Capitán,
you're needed in the palacio," he said from under his chin strap. "More trouble with the subversives, it seems."
"I'll send a car for you," the gangster promised.
"Wait," she said. "I'll go with you," not wanting to be left again, but he either didn't hear or didn't care.
"Wait, goddammit!"
she shouted in frustration. But the motorcycle never slowed.
"Wait!"
The ride never materialized either. Fortunately, Belly had gotten into the habit of stealing his money while he slept, so that she could maintain herself during his absences. Otherwise, she would have been stranded on that fucking beach.
After waiting 8 hours like a pariguaya, she hoisted her bag, left his shit in the cabana, and marched through the simmering heat like a vengeance on two legs. Walked for what felt like half a day, until at last she happened upon a colmado, where a couple of sun-stroked campesinos were sharing a warm beer while the colmadero, seated in the only shade in sight, waved the flies from his dulces. When they realized she was standing over them, they all scrambled to their feet. By then her anger had drained away and she only wanted to be spared further walking.
"Do you know anybody who has a car?"
And by noon, she was in a dust-choked Chevy, heading home.
"You better hold the door," the driver advised, "or it might fall off."
"Then it falls," she said, her arms firmly crossed. At one point they passed through one of those godforsaken blisters of a community that frequently afflict the arteries between the major cities. Sad assemblages of shacks that seemed to have been deposited in situ by a hurricane or other such calamity. The only visible commerce was a single goat carcass hanging unfetchingly from a rope, peeled down to its corded orange musculature, except for the skin of its face, which was still attached, like a funeral mask. He'd been skinned very recently. The flesh was still shivering under the shag of flies. Belly didn't know if it was the heat or the two beers she drank while the colmadero sent for his cousin, or the skinned goat, or dim memories of her lost years, but our girl could have sworn that a man sitting in a rocking chair in front of one of the hovels had no face, and he waved at her as she passed, but before she could confirm it, the pueblito vanished into the dust.
"Did you see something?"
Her driver sighed. "Please, I can barely keep my eyes on the road."
2 days after her return, the cold had settled in the pit of her stomach, like something drowned in there. She didn't know what was wrong. Every morning she was vomiting.
It was Lainka who saw it first.
"Well, you finally did it."
"You're pregnant."
"No, I'm not,"
Belly rasped, wiping the fetid mash from her mouth.
But she was. Revelation. When the doctor confirmed Lainka's worst fears, Belly let out a cheer.
"Young lady, this is not a game," the doctor barked.
She was simultaneously scared shitless and out of her mind with happiness. She couldn't sleep for the wonder of it, and, after the revelation, became strangely respectful and pliant.
"So now you're happy? My God, girl, are you a fool?"
For Belly, this was it. The magic she'd been waiting for. She placed her hand on her flat stomach and heard the wedding bells loud and clear, saw in her mind's eye the house that had been promised, that she had dreamed about.
"Please don't tell anyone," Lainka begged.
But of course, she whispered it to her friend Dorca, who put it out on the street. Success, after all, loves a witness, but failure can't exist without one. The bochincha spread through their sector of Bani like wildfire. The next time the gangster appeared, she had dolled herself up lovely, a brand new dress, crushed jasmine in her underwear, got her hair done, and even plucked her eyebrows into twin hyphens of alarm. He needed a shave and a haircut, and the hairs curling out of his ears were starting to look like a particularly profitable crop.
"You smell good enough to eat," he growled, kissing the tender glide of her neck.
"Guess what?" she said coyly.
He looked up.
"What?"
Upon further reflection. In her memory, he never told her to get rid of it. But later, when she was freezing in basement apartments in the Bronx and working her fingers to the bone, she reflected that he had told her exactly that.
But like lover girls everywhere, she had heard only what she wanted to hear. Name game.
I hope it's a son, she said.
I do too, half believing it. They were lying in bed in a love motel. Above them spun a fan, its blades pursued by a half dozen flies.
What will his middle name be? She wondered excitedly. It has to be something serious, because he's going to be a doctor like mi papa.
Before he could reply, she said,
We'll call him Abelard.
He scowled. What kind of maricón name is that? If the baby's a boy, we'll call him Manuel. That was my grandfather's name.
I thought you didn't know who your family was.
He pulled from her touch. No me jodas. Wounded, she reached down to hold her stomach. Truth and Consequences 1. The gangster had told Belly many things in the course of their relationship, but there was one important item he'd failed to reveal. That he was married. I'm sure you all guessed that. I mean, he was Dominicano, after all. But I bet you never would have imagined whom he was married to. A Trujillo. Truth and Consequences 2. It's true. The gangster's wife was, drumroll please, Trujillo's fucking sister. Do you really think some street punk from Samaná was going to reach the upper echelons of the Trujillato on hard work alone? Negro, please. This ain't a fucking comic book. Yes, Trujillo's sister. The one known affectionately as La Fea. They met while the gangster was carousing in Cuba. She was a bitter tacaña, 17 years his senior. They did a lot of work together in the butt business, and before you knew it, she had taken a shine to his irresistible joie de vivre. He encouraged it, knew a fantastic opportunity when he saw one, and before the year was out, they were cutting the cake and placing the first piece on el jefe's plate. There are those alive who claim that La Fea had actually been a pro herself in the time before the rise of her brother. But that seems to be more calumny than anything, like saying that Balaguer fathered a dozen illegitimate children and then used the pueblo's money to hush it up. Wait, that's true, but probably not the other. Shit, who can keep track of what's true and what's false in a country as bacá as ours? What is known is that the time before her brother's rise had made her una mujer bien fuerte y bien cruel. She was no pendeja, and ate girls like Belly like they were pan de agua. If this was Dickens, she'd have to run a brothel. But wait, she did run brothels. Well, maybe Dickens would have her run an orphanage. But she was one of those characters only a kleptocracy could have conceived. Had hundreds of thousands in the bank, and not one yuan of pity in her soul. She cheated everyone she did business with, including her brother, and had already driven two respectable businessmen to early graves by fleecing them to their last mota. She sat in her immense house in La Capital like a shelob in her web, all day handling accounts and ordering around subordinates, and on certain weekend nights, she would host tertulias where her friends would gather to endure hours of poetry declaimed by her preposterously tone-deaf son from her first marriage. She and the gangster didn't have any children. Well, one fine day in May, a servant appeared at her door. Leave it, she said, a pencil in her mouth. An inhalation. Doña, there's news. There's always news. Leave it. An exhale. News about your husband. In the shadow of the jacaranda. 2 days later, Belly was wandering about the Parque Central in a restless fog. Her hair had seen better days. She was out in the world because she couldn't stand to be at home with La Inca, and now that she didn't have a job, she didn't have a sanctuary into which to retreat. She was deep in thought, one hand on her belly, the other on her pounding head. She was thinking about the argument she and the gangster had gotten into earlier in the week. He'd been in one of his foul moods and bellowed suddenly that he didn't want to bring a baby into so terrible a world, and she had barked that the world wasn't so terrible in Miami. And then he'd said, grabbing her by the throat, "If you're in such a rush to go to Miami, swim." He hadn't tried to contact her since, and she was wandering around in the hopes of spotting him, as if he hung around Bani. Her feet were swollen, her head was sending its surplus ache down her neck, and now two huge men with matching pompadours were grabbing her by the arms and propelling her to the center of the parque, where a well-dressed old lady sat on a bench underneath a decrepit jacaranda. White gloves and a coil of pearls about her neck, scrutinizing belly with unflinching iguana eyes. "Do you know who I am?"
"I don't know who in carajo."
"Soy Trujillo. I'm also Dionisio's wife. It has reached my ears that you've been telling people that you're going to marry him and that you're having his child. Well, I'm here to inform you, mi monita, that you will be doing neither. These two very large and capable officers are going to take you to a doctor, and after he's cleaned out that toto podrido of yours, there won't be any baby left to talk about. And then it will be in your best interest that I never see your black cara de culo again, because if I do, I'll feed you to my dogs myself. But enough talk. It's time for your appointment. Say goodbye now. I don't want you to be late." Belly might have felt as though the crone had thrown boiling oil on her, but she still had the ovaries to spit,
"Cómeme el culo, you ugly, disgusting vieja!"
"Let's go," Elvis One said, twisting her arm behind her back and, with the help of his partner, dragging her across the park to where a car sat baleful in the sun.
"Déjame!"
she screamed, and when she looked up, she saw that there was one more cop sitting in the car, and when he turned toward her, she saw that he didn't have a face. All the strength fell right out of her. "That's right. Tranquila now," the larger one said. What a sad ending it would have been had not our girl rolled her luck and spotted Jose Ten ambling back from one of his gambling trips, a rolled newspaper under his arm. She tried to say his name, but like in those bad dreams we all have, there was no air in her lungs. It wasn't until they tried to force her into the car, and her hand brushed the burning chrome of the car, that she found her tongue.
"Jose," she whispered, "please save me."
And then the spell was broken.
"Shut up!"
The Elvises struck her in the head and back, but it was too late. Jose Ten was running over, and behind him, a miracle, were his brother Juan and the rest of the Palacio Peking crew, Constantina, Marco Antonio, and Indian Benny. The grunts tried to draw their pistols, but Belly was all over them, and then Jose planted his iron next to the biggest one's skull, and everybody froze, except, of course, Belly.
"You hijos de puta! I'm pregnant! Do you understand? Pregnant!"
She spun to where the crone had held court, but she had, inexplicably, vanished.
"This girl's under arrest," one grunt said sullenly.
"No, she's not." Jose tore Belly out of their arms.
"You alone her!"
yelled Juan, a machete in each hand.
"Listen, Chino. You don't know what you're doing. This Chino knows exactly what he's doing."
Jose cocked the pistol, a noise most dreadful, like a rib breaking. His face was a dead rictus, and in it shone everything he had lost. "Run, Belly," he said. And she ran, tears popping out of her eyes, but not before taking one last kick at the grunts.
"Mis Chinos," she told her daughter, "saved my life."
hesitation.
She should have kept running, too, but she beelined for home instead. Can you believe it? Like everybody in this damn story, she underestimated the depth of the shit she was in.
What's the matter, hija?
La Inca said, dropping the frying pan in her hand and holding the girl.
You have to tell me.
Belly shook her head, couldn't catch her breath. Latched the door and the windows and then crouched on her bed, a knife in her hand, trembling and weeping, the cold in her stomach like a dead fish.
I want Dionisio, she blubbered. I want him now!
What happened? She should have scrammed, I tell you. But she needed to see her gangster, needed him to explain what was happening. Despite everything that had just transpired, she still held out the hope that he would make everything better, that his gruff voice would soothe her heart and stop the animal fear gnawing her guts. Poor Belly. She believed in the gangster, was loyal to the end. Which was why a couple hours later, when a neighbor shouted,
Oye, Inca, the novio is outside.
She bolted out of bed like she'd been shot from a masked driver, blew past La Inca, past caution, ran barefoot to where his car was waiting. In the dark, she failed to notice that it wasn't actually his car.
Did you miss us?
Elvis One asked, slapping cuffs on her wrist. She tried to scream, but it was too late.
End of Disc 4.
La Inca, the Divine. After the girl had bolted from the house, and after she was informed by the neighbors that the secret police had scooped her up, La Inca knew in her ironclad heart that the girl was Fantuche, that the doom of the Cabrals had managed to infiltrate her circle at last. Standing on the edge of the neighborhood, rigid as a post, staring hopelessly into the night, she felt herself borne upon a cold tide of despair as bottomless as our needs. A thousand reasons why it might have happened, starting, of course, with the accursed gangster, but none as important as the fact that it had. Stranded out in that growing darkness, without a name, an address, or a relative in the palacio, La Inca almost succumbed, let herself be lifted from her moorings and carried like a child, like a tangle of sea grape, beyond the bright reef of her faith, and into the dark reaches. It was in that hour of tribulation, however, that a hand reached out for her, and she remembered who she was.
Millotis Altagracia Toribio Cabral, one of the mighty of the Sur.
You must save her, her husband's spirit said, or no one else will. Shrugging off her weariness, she did what many women of her background would have done. Posted herself beside her portrait of La Virgen de Altagracia and prayed. We postmodern platanos tend to dismiss the Catholic devotion of our viejas as atavistic, an embarrassing throwback to the olden days, but it's exactly at these moments, when all hope has vanished, when the end draws near, that prayer has dominion. Let me tell you, true believers, in the annals of Dominican piety there has never been prayer like this. The rosaries cabling through La Inca's fingers like line flying through a doomed fisherman's hands. And before you could say, holy, 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 she was joined by a flock of women, young and old, fierce and mansa, serious and alegre, and even those who had previously bagged on the girl and called her whore, arriving without invitation and taking up the prayer without as much as a whisper. Dorca was there, and the wife of the dentist, and many, many others. In no time at all, the room was filled with the faithful and pulsed with a spirit so dense that it was rumored that the devil himself had to avoid the sur for months afterward. La Inca didn't notice. A hurricane could have carried off the entire city, and it wouldn't have broken her concentration. Her face veined, her neck corded, the blood roaring in her ears.
too lost, too given over to drawing the girl back from the abyss, was she? So furious and so unrelenting, in fact, was La Inca's pace that more than a few women suffered shatat, spiritual burnout, and collapsed, never again to feel the divine breath of the Todopoderoso on their neck.
One woman even lost the ability to determine right from wrong, and a few years later became one of Balaguer's chief deputies. By night's end, only three of the original circle remained. La Inca, of course, her friend and neighbor Momona, who it was said could cure warts and sex an egg just by looking at it, and a plucky seven-year-old whose piety until then had been obscured by a penchant for blowing mucus out her nostrils like a man. To exhaustion and beyond they prayed, to that glittering place where the flesh dies and is born again, where all is agony, and finally, just as La Inca was feeling her spirit begin to loose itself from its earthly pinions, just as the circle began to dissolve. Choice and Consequences. They drove east. In those days, the cities hadn't yet metastasized into kaiju, menacing one another with smoking, teeming tendrils of shanties. In those days, their limits were a Corbusian dream. The urban dropped off as precipitous as a beet. One second you were deep in the 20th century, well, the 20th century of the Third World, and the next you'd find yourself plunged 180 years into rolling fields of cane. The transition between these states was some real-time machine-type shit. The moon, it has been reported, was full, and the light that rained down cast the leaves of the eucalyptuses into spectral coin. The world outside, so beautiful. But inside the car, they'd been punching her, and her right eye had puffed up into a malignant slit, her right breast so preposterously swollen that it looked like it would burst. Her lip was split, and something was wrong with her jaw. She couldn't swallow without causing herself excruciating shocks of pain. She cried out each time they struck her, but she did not cry, ¿entiendes? Her fierceness astounds me. She wouldn't give them the pleasure. There was such fear, the sickening, blood-draining fear of a drawn pistol, of waking up to find a man standing over your bed, but held a note sustained indefinitely. Such fear, and yet she refused to show it. How she hated these men. For her whole life she would hate them, never forgive, never forgive, and she would never be able to think of them without succumbing to a vortex of rage. Anyone else would have turned her face from the blows, but Belly offered hers up, and between punches she brought up her knees to comfort her stomach. "You'll be okay," she whispered through a broken mouth. "You live. Dios mío." They parked the car on the edge of the road and marched her into the cane. They walked until the cane was roaring so loud around them it sounded as if they were in the middle of a storm. Our girl, she kept flinging her head to get her hair out of her face, could think only about her poor little boy, and that was the sole reason she started to weep. The large grunt handed his partner a nightstick. "Let's hurry up."
"No,"
Belly said. How she survived, I'll never know. They beat her like she was a slave, like she was a dog. Let me pass over the actual violence and report instead on the damage inflicted. Her clavicle, chicken-boned. Her right humerus, a triple fracture. She would never again have much strength in that arm. Five ribs broken. Left kidney bruised. Liver bruised. Right lung collapsed. Front teeth blown out. About 167 points of damage in total. And it was only sheer accident that these motherfuckers didn't eggshell her cranium. Though her head did swell to elephant man proportions. Was there time for a rape or two? I suspect there was, but we shall never know because it's not something she talked about. All that can be said is that it was the end of language, the end of hope. It was the sort of beating that breaks people, breaks them utterly. Throughout most of the